Hello and welcome to Willosophy with Will Anderson. I'm Will Anderson from the title of the podcast. Sorry, we've been away for a while because, we're on a break. Those who've listened to this podcast over the years will know I've always had a very complicated relationship with it. One of the things I talk about a little bit on the podcast is this idea of, asking yourself the question, how is my relationship with, and, you know, whether it's how is my relationship with alcohol or how is my relationship with other people in my life. One that comes back to me quite a lot about this podcast is how is my relationship with this podcast? And sometimes it's very strong and positive and has great momentum. And then sometimes it ruins my life a little bit. Of late, it's been more the latter than the former. But so we've had a little break. My heart wasn't really in it for a bit. And the main reason for that is really simple, that I always feel really grateful that people come on this podcast and share what they have to share and are so completely honest with me about what they think. And the audience is amazing. The audience has been incredibly supportive of people coming on and doing that. And that is the reason that, you know, people have trusted me to come on, talk to me on the podcast and share these things. Unfortunately, of late, some of that stuff that people have said to me on the podcast has been, you know, rebroadcast in other forums and, had blowback on people's lives. And, that's not something I want. I don't want someone to come around and do my bloody free podcast that they're not getting paid for and give me their time and then it cause a pain in the ass in the rest of their life. So for a little while, I've just not wanted to do it. That's the truth of it. I had a couple recorded already, one of which is this today's episode. And so what we're going to do is we're going to publish the remaining couple that I had already recorded, and then we're going to have a really decent break, and I'm going to have a think about whether I want to bring the podcast back or not. Look, we haven't ruled out the idea. This might not be the end. I've quit the podcast many, many times before, and, this is probably just one of those times. It's probably just me having needing a couple of months to have a think about it all and have a think about what I want to do with it and, what I can put in place going forward so that people can come in and still share the amazing things that they share with me without, feeling that they have to protect their words or what they say because it might be, sort of taken out of context and used in other places and, misrepresented. So basically, I'm going to have a break. So thank you to everyone who's said so many positive things about it and shared it around and had a listen. And look, there's 50-odd episodes, back catalog, so you can always spend some time having a listen to those. What we might do in the interim is perhaps go through some of the old podcasts and maybe put together some theme episodes, different times that I've asked, different guests the same question. Perhaps we'll put together some compilations of their various different responses and answers, but that's going to involve somebody else other than me having to go and do that because, I find it incredibly difficult to listen to myself or watch myself and do those things. So it's not something that I have the capacity to do myself, but we're hoping that somebody else might do that. This is a good opportunity to just thank Mike Hell, our US-based producer who edits it all together, and podcast Mike, young Michael Liberale, who is fantastic. An amazing talent and the real reason that you were hearing this weekly for a while and basically the reason that I didn't just throw it all in the bin and decide to stop doing it completely has been Mike's sort of steady encouragement through this whole last sort of month or so. So this episode today, I'll just move on now. That's enough. That's the intro. That's why we haven't been here for a while. You know what? You might not even be listening to this in order anyway. So I'm not going to bang on about it too much, and I'll, probably change my mind in a couple of months. So in the meantime, here's what's going to happen. I've got three more to put up, actually, technically. There is today's episode, which is Daniel Sloss. We recorded this during the Melbourne International Comedy Festival. Daniel Sloss is a brilliant Scottish stand-up comedian. He's about to have a couple of specials on Netflix that you can check out. Speaking of Netflix, please watch Hannah Gadsby's show, Nanette. It's one of the great all-time stand-up specials, and it is now available on Netflix. And Hannah is one of those guests that, you know, we've organized a couple of times to do the podcast. And because of the great success of Nanette, her career has just been taking her all over the world. And we haven't been able to manage to sit down and have the conversation. So maybe that'll be the one. Maybe that'll be the one that brings me back to the podcast when Hannah and I find some time to sit down and have a chat. But in the meantime, I've got three left. Now, ordinarily, I wouldn't put out three blokes in a row, but it's just the three that I have left to put up, and I'm not recording any new ones at the moment. So this is what's going to happen. Daniel Sloss today, the brilliant Daniel Sloss. Then a chat I had with Sammy Shah about a month or so ago. And then after that, we're going to re-release the Jules Lund episode, which will be back up. That'll be the final one we put up. So the next 3 weeks will be episodes that will go up, and then after that we're going to have a decent break and a regroup and a rethink and see if we're going to go forward with the podcast or not. So anyway, thanks so much to everyone who supported it. You can still go to the Facebook or the Twitter or the Instagram, and these things, the great thing about the internet and the way it works now is that these things sit around and people can discover them and go through them and explore them at their own pace. So, you don't need me to be putting them out weekly. So I hope you enjoy today's episode. It's an absolute cracker. Daniel's the best. If you've heard him on my other podcast, Fofop, he's been a regular guest on that, where we have some pretty outrageous conversations. He's provocative. He's intentionally provocative. He's young, and he has a lot of firm and strong opinions. He's one of the nicest guys in comedy as well. He's just a genuinely great dude, and I really enjoy just sitting down and having the opportunity to chat with him. So I hope you enjoy it too. This is Daniel Sloss. Hello and welcome to Willosophy with Will Anderson. That's very unprofessional.
Yeah, sorry. I tried to do it off mic.
Yeah, I mean, you probably did. I probably didn't need to. I probably could have. And you know what? Mike Howell, my producer, probably could have just edited it out because you hadn't actually spoken yet. So he could probably just drop your separate line out of the podcast. And the only reason I have to keep it in now is because I've commented upon it.
Yeah.
Welcome to the podcast. This is Willosophy. My next guest, some of you will know if you listen to my other podcast, Fofop, because he has been a regular visitor to that podcast, and we've had some of the most fun chats that we've ever had on that podcast. So if you like today and you've never heard the Fofops, go and find those and listen to us have probably slightly more outrageous conversations about things than we might have here today. But this is a different podcast, and this is how it starts. Guest, I ask this question: who are you?
I'm Daniel Sloss, and I am a comedian, obviously. And it's weird that I define myself as that, but yeah, that's...
It's part of the reason I asked the question, right? Because I like to hear what people say. Because it is that sort of thing when somebody says to you, not what's your name, but who are you? Yeah. That you, there is some sort of temptation to fill the hole with something.
I feel like a lot of the time people would, in that situation, obviously try and vie away from their occupation, because they go, you know, it doesn't define me. I'm so much more than, you know, what I do for a living. But like, I've been doing comedy since I was 16 years old. I've been doing it for like 10 years now. That's over a third of my life. And I'll be honest with you, before that, I was just a fucking annoying teenager. Like the most important thing I've done, and the thing that has given me the most value in life so far, is stand-up comedy. So, because it's led to all the other things I love in my life.
It's interesting to me because, you know, absolutely. Some people do answer with their jobs, and some people answer with something that is more broad than that, something that defines them as a human being outside what it is that they do. But with you, I think what you've said is very true, and it's something that I find very interesting about you, because in a general sense, and there is no general sense, because some of the most brilliant comedians of all time started when they were 15, 16 years old. You know, yep. Ross Noble and Eddie Murphy and, you know, all these
Bill
people.
Bill Hicks, Seth Rogen, right? Yep.
You know, brilliant teenage people who wanted to be stand-up comedians. Tom Ballard here in Australia, you know, teenage stand-up comedian. And brilliant, you know, stand-up comedians. And there's a little bit of me that I started when I was 21 or 22, I think maybe. And once you're doing something that you know that you're going to do for the rest of your life, you're like, what the fuck was I doing wasting all this time before I started doing this? But at the same time, I think as I've got older, I appreciated that I did something else before I did comedy because I have something else to compare comedy to.
Yeah,
and so when comedy is at its worst, I can still be reminded that comedy at its worst is still better than everything else at its best, pretty much.
Yeah, I think that's a great sort of comparison. It's that, you know, no matter how bad it gets, you'll always know that it was better than the previous life. I don't necessarily have that. My only other job before this was I was a paintball referee, which is worse than it sounds by 1,000 fucking miles.
I was gonna say, because it does actually kind of, on just first glance, it sounds fun,
which is why I took the job, because I was like, this will be the funnest job in the world. I'm a paintball referee. I was 16 and my job was to take out like groups of 40 men and arm them fully with markers, paintball markers, while they all wear camouflage, and I would wear bright red and a bright yellow mask, and I would have one marker that didn't have any bullets in it, and my job would be, if any of their markers broke, I would walk up to them, I'd swap their hopper, which is their ammo thing, over, and then just start fixing their one. And I'll be honest with you, most people will just shoot a 16-year-old if they haven't seen something in about 5 fucking seconds. And there's nothing I can do. There's nothing I can do. I don't have any ammo. I don't have any. I'm just there. They'll just get bored. It'll hit you. I can't send them off. I don't know who did it. I know who fucking did it. Of course I know who fucking did it. I'm not an idiot. I know where the things. But I'm 16. They're grown men. They're on stag dudes. They're all on fucking coke or they're shit faced for whatever reason. And yeah, just kind of. The worst one was when they used to get like kids who were like, you know, troubled kids who were on 3 weeks good behavior would then go like, oh, let's take them to paintball. I'm like, no. Let them swim. Like, just give them something that, like, it was the dumbest, worst thing in the world.
It's interesting insight into humanity, though, that you experience, which is that grown men in that pack environment have absolutely no respect for the fact that you're a 16-year-old child. They don't give a shit.
Oh, no,
you're
and
like
I would
a warm prop to their amusement.
I would actually, now, even with the experience of being a paintballer, I would never go paintballing ever just because I know how much of a ripoff and a scam it is. But if I was ever doing it, standing, you bet your ass the first person I'm shooting is the marshal, because in my books, I'm like, no, you go through exactly what I went through. You, like, that's, it's not fair that you get a better life now in this situation. You've got to experience it to help me grow as a person. So it helped me develop humor a lot in comedy. Like, I was just like, I cannot get these 40 men to respect me by my stature or my skills. I'm 60. I don't have knowledge. The only way I can get them to respect me is if I make them like me. And from a very, very young age, I've realized the way to get people to like me was through laughter, you know.
So where did that come from then?
I think it came from my family. A lot of it came from my family. I have a genuinely hilarious family, like extended family and whatnot, and not in the way that other people are like, oh, my dad's wacky, or, you know, my uncle's always coming up with these funny limericks at Christmas. My family are genuinely humorous people, very viciously funny. It's you know, sort of friendly, insulting stuff. There was, so comedy and laughter always had value in my family, like, and it was a way that I could get out of trouble as well. It definitely worked in school. Like, I was a pretty shitty kid a lot of the time, and if I ever did something, you know, in the playground, if I fucking tripped someone up during football, and utterly intentionally, of course I did it intentionally, I was a horrible kid, and they fell over and they started screaming, the way I would get them to stop crying is to try and make them laugh, and then it got me out of trouble. So, you know, on several, it got people to like me, it got me out of trouble, and I was just like being known as the funny one.
So these things are never as simple as the very simple thing I'm about to paint. But it's funny to me because knowing the sort of comedy that you make now, it feels to me that so much of the DNA of it is in that moment. Like, so much of your comedy still to this day is about sort of intentionally tripping somebody over and then charming your way out of something that was clearly of your making in the first place.
100%, yeah. I'll say something that, you know, is designed to, not necessarily designed to shock you, like, I don't want the reaction of the shock, but I know how you'll react, and I know that you're, you know, wrong. Because when I first thought of the thing I'm talking about, it's an awful thought, or it's an awful thing. So I'll say it to you, but then I'll talk my way out of it. Like, in my last show last year, I had this whole routine. I didn't want to do it for years because I just thought it was the worst thing I'd ever thought. And then the amount of audiences that laughed at it So I would get that exact reaction. I would shock them and bring them back on board. And it was, if you've been in one of those relationships where there's nothing wrong with the relationship, you just don't love each other anymore. And that's never a valid excuse to break up with someone. It doesn't feel like it because it just feels broken. So if you've ever been in one of those relationships where you're trapped and you find yourself thinking one day how much easier your life would be if your partner was to just die. Like, it's the easiest way out of that relationship. There's no awkward breakup. Your friends are going to encourage you to move on sooner than if you like broke up. You're not a monster for breaking up. You don't have to, there's no introspection that you have to go through, this horrible thing of how flawed a human. It's the easiest way out. People feel sorry for you as opposed to, you broke her, his heart. Like, oh, they died. You must be, oh yeah, I don't know if I'll ever get over them. And I remember thinking that, and it was a thought that came to me in a relationship. And the second I had the thought, I was like, that is a horrendous thing to think. And I now have to break up with this person because they deserve better than this. Regardless of their flaws or their shortcomings, they deserve better than someone who would be nonplussed.
Their life would be more convenient if they die.
Yeah, if you just, that's not, you never want to be. Like, if you were to die, I'm meant to be the love of your life. I'm not meant to just shrug off your death.
Do you know what? It's cleared up my diary a bit for next week, actually.
It has,
A few of those no's or maybes I replied to on Facebook become yeses.
You know what? I'm suddenly clear. I can finally go back to being myself. I don't have to lie anymore.
I'm going to watch a lot more Fox footy.
And I remember thinking it and thinking, fuck, that is awful. And then... to myself, sort of going through, be like, it is a funny thought, though. It's funny because of how fucked up it is. And then it's, you know, saying it to the audience, just being like, because even though, of course, 30% of the audience will be like, oh my God, no, I've never thought that. The other 70 have been like, it, you know what? It has crossed my mind. It's very human. And I like those sort of jokes where you catch them off guard and then you slowly bring them round to your way of thinking.
So that observation in and of itself is I think is just a genuinely brilliant, evil but empathetic human observation. And I think that's when your comedy is at its best, you know, when you are able to be like, you are actually, while it feels like you're being a bit evil with it, like there's also a level there of going, I am letting you acknowledge the darkness that is inside you.
Yeah.
And the way that we all, you know, sometimes, even if you do love that person, like if you genuinely, like, I mean, because there will be people in that audience who've had that thought.
Yeah.
But it is not the prevailing thought in their life. No,
it just comes up once.
It was
not
just
ongoing.
That day or that situation or that series of events that led to the moment where they sat there and thought, you know what?
It wouldn't matter.
It's just if they died.
It's just if they... If
just
they
right just, now.
Yeah. I didn't murder them. Yeah. It was a tragic accident.
Oh, no. I definitely don't... Like, I mean, I'm not even saying I want them to die.
No.
I'm just saying, if they died,
it would not be as bad as if it was 3 weeks ago when I actually loved them.
Right.
As opposed to, I'm just saying it would be easier at this point for me to get over them.
So, and the reason that is probably so rarely voiced is that I would say for the majority of people, it's only a fleeting thought ever, and they go back to the next day that being an idea that they never would.
Yeah,
like, and then they never talk about it. Because you would never bring that up as a funny story with your partner or whatever.
Honestly, so there was just a point last week. You remember the toaster wasn't working. You kept turning it up too much and it burned one side. And I told you it was on toasty thing, but you didn't listen to me. I was just thinking to myself about that. If you died that moment, like, I honestly wouldn't have given a shit. But now I love you. But now, baby, where are you going? Like, you can never bring it up comfortably because there's rightfully. Because even if I put myself in the shit, if one of my ex-girlfriends while we're together being like, man, if you just died last week, I wouldn't give a shit. I'm like, you are so fucking dumb. Like, right? I need you to need me. I don't want you to want me.
Or at the very least, I'll just go. If you're feeling like that, like,
I'll just move out. There's just, easier ways. I can be dead to you, but can I be alive to everyone else?
We'll try that first, at the very least. Yeah, yeah. Right?
Let's do a general consensus. Let's do.
You know what? You can actually pretend that I'm dead.
Yeah.
And mourned in that way. That'll be a much less complicated breakup. Maybe that's how people should have to break up. Instead of going through that period of time where, like, you actually tell one of them that the other one's dead. Yeah. And then it's like a witness relocation program of some sort.
Yeah, and then it's just an awkward, it's like the end of The Dark Knight Rises, just in a couple of years in the future, and it's just Alfred in France, and he looks over, and does he see him or does he not?
Well, or maybe it's that thing of like, you know, in Japan or whatever, you can pay, you know, it's a status thing, so you can pay for mourners to come to your funeral who aren't actually, or women, they're doing a thing now where you can have your wedding, even if you're not got a partner or whatever, so you can get your wedding photos when you're at your...
Really?
Yeah, so they're doing these services, right? Or it's like an escape room. You know, it's a fantasy service where you're putting yourself in this. Maybe we could just hire a bunch of people to literally mourn in the way as if the person was dead.
Yeah.
Like, you've just moved to another suburb, into a share house or whatever. But, you know, they have people bring over food. You know, you all sit around, you talk about the good times, people hug you.
Do you have that... is a question for you. Do you have that level of narcissism? I'm the level of narcissist that I absolutely... definitely think about my funeral quite a lot, and it upsets me because of how upset I know everyone will be there in my head.
I have a very different perspective on that. I'd like to revisit yours. I'll tell you mine quickly, and yes, then let's go back to yours. Mine is the opposite. I am now at a stage in my life where I would welcome death, sudden death. It's my favorite. It's my ultimate fantasy that I'll just suddenly die and it'll all be over.
Oh God! Like, is this an intervention?
I don't like being sick. I'm not like looking for some sort of long drawn out. I don't need to do a show about it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I don't want to have to get the lump and then tour, you know, my show about the lump, my award winning lump show for a year coming, and then die.
Coming to terms with it. Yeah.
I don't want that. I want like sudden death. It's all over. Move on. But the problem is, and I shouldn't care about this once I'm dead, because what I believe is that I'll be dead and I will have no sense of anything that's ever happening ever again is. But every time I make a mistake, every time I make a fuck up, I realize that I have to live for a bit longer so that the immediate thing people don't go to is the fuck up. Do you know what I mean? Because in my head, when I die, they go to your most immediate, like, you know, thing. Yeah. And if my most immediate last thing was a fuck up of some kind, I'm like, oh, great. Now I have to live for another 6 months.
Yeah, just to rebuild some just trust. Just despite that memory
of myself.
Something
good.
Yeah, I got to start a charity.
Don't want that last thing that comes up when people Google me to be that chortle review.
Yeah, fuck. And now that's in my head. But for me, what that means is I have to live forever, because I don't think I'll ever get to a point in my life where I've ever gone a 2-week period without massively fucking up somehow.
Well, that is part of the problem. You know, that is. So take me back to yours. I like the idea of somebody imagining their own death or their own funeral. This podcast normally ends up talking about death anyway, but we've jumped in the deep end, so that's fun. So when you imagine your death, what are you imagining in this kind
how
of...
How I die?
Yeah. Well, not just how you die, but how it's celebrated or how you're remembered or the things that are around it in whatever this, you know, fantasy is.
In my head, what it is the funeral's actually quite fun, right? Because everyone just goes... I've always said that what I want at my funeral to be is I want all of my friends and my family to get on stage and say the worst thing they can about me. One of the worst personality traits about me, or one of the worst moments where I was just such an unforgivable dick, which they'll all have plenty of. And then, because I want by the end of the funeral, people to be like, I don't miss him that much anymore.
Right.
Like, you know what? Good riddance. Right?
Well, maybe that's what you got to do in the relationship breakup.
Yeah.
You've got to have like a roast. Maybe Jeffrey Ross should start offering this as a service. And when you break up with someone, he just comes around and roasts them on all their worst. And you're like, hey, I don't miss them.
Yeah, that is. Yeah, that would. Yeah, that works if you're the one that got dumped. If you're the one that got your heart broken, you absolutely get someone to come around to be like. But then again, that's what your friends are.
Right, but they're not professional roast masters.
They're not. No, but to me, I hate when my friends, like, they break up with some their partner or something. And then I'm like, right, here's my job, right? I will fucking. Here's all the things I hated about this person while you dated. Now I've got full room to say. And then 3 weeks later, they're like, we're back together. And I'm like, I could never see this person ever again. Like, I tore them a new fucking hole. And now that you've given me freedom to express how much I dislike that person, you can't just suddenly be like, nah, pretend again. No, I'm not. No, no, no. You made me drop the act. The act has dropped. If you can keep that illusion up for a fair period of time, more power to you. I'm not going to attend the fucking wedding. Unless you want the wedding to be another fucking roast of your piece of shit boyfriend or girlfriend.
Are you a person who craves, I mean, you're a young person, so when you're a young person, you feel like life is going to go forever. Do you have a sense of, I never imagined, I honestly, and I don't know why, not for any reason in particular, but I just never imagined that I'd still be, in my mid 40s, fucking like doing this and being alive. And I just like, do you know what I mean? Like, it wasn't like I thought that I was going to necessarily die when I was 27 in a, you know, a
pool. Oh, I absolutely did. And I still reckon I might die. That's, again, where my level of narcissism is. Like, I thought, oh, of course I'll join the 27 guy.
Because I'm also one of the all-time greats.
Yes, right. If I don't die at 27, I'm not a big genius as I thought I was. Yeah. I've been living, every year after this, I'm going to be like, should have been then. Because after that, I don't need to do any more work. There's a finite limit. The potential of my brain you'll never see because I'm dead. They're like, oh my God, he was on this path. It could have gone up to there. Realistically, it's not fucking gonna. And you'll all work that out by the time I get to 31. And they're like, I mean, he's all right. Yeah, he's still good. He's, you know.
I think that, now that you've said it like that, I think that what I would love to do if I could ideally time my own death, it's right at the start of the dip.
yeah.
Just at the point where people will think I still had greatness in front of me.
Yeah.
And they haven't realized that I've been on a gradual downhill slide for years and I had nothing really that interesting to say.
Instead of the first person noticing, just suddenly, hold on, this is getting worse. Instead of killing them, you're just like, and now I die and they're a slanderer.
Right.
Because if I die, no, if you die when you're just going down on the downgrade, no one is allowed to say, his last show wasn't that great, was it? Right. Like, he was like, you can't do that. Nobody is allowed to say that, right? The second someone says it to me, I'm necking myself, it's done. Because I know for a fact, no matter how shit you think my last show is, you are not allowed to say at any point, you know what, it's probably for the best. I'm allowed to say it, and I'm allowed to admit that. But you, as my friend, you're not allowed to be like, and especially because I'm dead, you're just besmirching my name. I'm still warm for crying out loud. How dare you?
How would you... I mean, there is an element of you, and I don't... it's always very hard for me to know how much of it is pretend and how much of it is real, because you are... It comes very naturally for you to refer to yourself as a narcissist or to refer to your ego or, you know, these kind of, you know, like slightly... boastful like ways of speaking about things.
Yeah.
But there's a way that you do it that I think even for someone like me, who I don't know you that well, but like, we've known each other for a while now and we've like, you know, I feel like I know you.
I know you pretty well. We've had some very, very deep conversations on and off air.
Yeah, I'm going to say that then. All right. So I wonder, like, what is that exactly? Do you think it's, because it's not what it appears to be, I don't think, but it's there as a constant of like how you present yourself. What is that?
It could be, I don't know. It could be a large number of things. For me, first of all, I do love being confident. And look, and apart from the female orgasm, confidence is the easiest thing in the world to fake. Like, it genuinely is. And not only can you trick other people into thinking you're confident, you can trick yourself into thinking you're confident. Anytime that I feel down, I'm just, you know, watch Conor McGregor videos. And I love the feeling of being confident. And there was definitely a time when I was about 20, 21, when my career in the UK was on a trajectory. I'd done a bunch of TV shows, getting, you know, being young and successful and stuff, and it absolutely went to my head to the point when I had, and I still to this day I still thank these people for doing it, people at The Stand and a bunch of like producers and agents I worked, took me aside and they were like, you have to stop this immediately before you become fully we're saying it as your friends, you're becoming unbearable, this is not the reason everyone likes you isn't because, you know, you're an arrogant, it's because you were just so very friendly all the time. And I was like, they were 100% correct. I was turning into a piece of shit. And so since then, instead of trying to just make amends for it, I just thought I would parody it through myself. Utterly parody it. And sometimes you know, my friends point out to me when I'll say something incredibly arrogant and they were like, that wasn't ironic then, was it? And I'll be like, no, it wasn't. I believed that. And those are always moments when I have to go, all right, this is when we fucking rein it in. But I like the, you know, I love being a lovable asshole. Like, I really like the fact, in my head, I know your perception of yourself is very different to how other people see it, but I like the fact if you were to ask most comedians at the Melbourne Comedy Festival, if you were to mention my name, I would be willing to bet 75% of being, Slossy's such a fucking cunt. but I love them. And I like that.
Right.
You know?
That you, and I think that that's, you know, probably being a bit generous that many people would know who you are. But
I meant on the comedy circuit. I meant amongst the comics. I like that. Yeah.
No, well, here's what I'm going to say. And these are why I think these are kind of, and why I think this is interesting and why these things are, you know, counter-contextual or whatever they are, is because you probably, as much or more so than maybe any of the international comedians, have not only just come over here to work, but you've, it was a bit of a tough path here at various stages for you. When things were going very well for you in other places, it was, it didn't immediately, you know, all click into place here in the same way as it was everywhere else. I mean, it has now, but there were periods of time early on where I think if you were the truly arrogant narcissist, you would have been like, fuck Australia, burn that whole joint down. I'm going to go back to where they think I'm a genius and I'm never going to think of this place again. And you did not do that. So firstly, talk to me about that.
I think, honestly, I think a lot of that comes down to another thing that genuinely fuels me, which is spite. I'd love to say it came from a mature place where I was like, you know what, I'm gonna keep doing it. You gotta find the good.
Spite can be useful,
man. Spite and hate are two things that genuinely utterly fuel me. Like, I was talking to, and friends have said that's a fucked up thing, and I'm like, it fucking works though,
right?
You know, I didn't get to do Melbourne for many years when I wanted to, when I was doing other parts of Australia. And, you know, there was utter jealousy, not in the fact that people were getting to, not only that people were getting to this great festival, but just like, all my mates were drinking in a fucking city and I wasn't invited to that city to go drinking. And you just get in your head like, why am I not invited? Why am I, like, what is it? Is it political? Is it me? Is it whatever?
Well, you would have to have been thinking that.
100%.
Because everywhere else it kind of opened you, it welcomed you with open arms.
Yeah.
Your experience pretty much around the world, and I mean, it has continued to be the case. You know, you've done great stuff in America and, you know, traveled around like Europe and stuff and done, you know, gigs all over the place and have followings all over the place. And the world's biggest specialist comedy festival, like, I mean, you know, there's Edinburgh, but it's a fringe festival.
Yeah. And also, I live there, so I cheat.
And, well, that's right.
Yeah.
And then there's Montreal, but that's more a trade convention that has some shows at it. Melbourne is essentially an open to all festival,
and it was
except for you.
Yeah,
like there was a period of time where I mean, it was doing my head in a little bit because we'd already met and become friendly, and I thought you were very funny, and I just could not understand what was going on. And I imagine if you're the person, that sort of shit might drive you a little bit crazy.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, genuinely, and spite absolutely. Yeah. It made me not. I mean, don't get me wrong. Like, I can't guarantee that it's not going to affect me again in the future when it comes to this festival.
Right,
but like, it's just. Yeah, it's FOMO, and also why am I not? And it's the bit I always hate when you're, and I do it, but it's one of the worst things I fucking hate about myself, is whenever I don't get something and somebody else does, it's the comparisons. It's like I don't get to compare myself to my mates because we all do very different types of stand up. Like, very different. Nick Cody's got one of my favorite ways of the reason he never gets jealous of other comedians is because he's like, everyone's in their own, it's like the UFC, everyone's in their own weight division. Like, he's like, yeah, I'm not doing as well as Auntie Donna. And that's because Auntie Donna are a multiple person sketch group that do music. Like, yeah, it's entirely different sports. I can't compare myself to that. Whereas not being invited to this thing for so many years, I was like, what? You know, I never want to look at one of my mates and go, I'm better than him. It's a horrible fucking feeling, but it did cross my mind so many times. And now, finally, everyone else feels that about me.
You have certainly made an effort, whether it's just natural or whether it's been intentional or whether it's been a combination of both. But again, I would say of the international visitors to our festival, and this is a big festival, you know, there's 800 shows or something this year and, you know, a load of internationals. And I've been doing it for 22 years. And my experience has been that while the internationals might come out regularly, they don't necessarily ever particularly become part of the scene or form particularly close, you know, bonds or friendships with, yeah, they might have a couple of friends or, you know, whatever that they've made over here. But, you know, they don't become part of the community in a way that you have become part of the Australian comedy community. How did that happen?
I wouldn't give myself any credit in that situation. Just like, that's down to the the comedians here that I just feel so welcome. I can be very hard to get on with sometimes, but I can also, you know, put on the fucking front of I'll just be nice to everyone. First came over when I was about 18, met Reese Nicholson. We just absolutely fell in love with each other because we were both kids at this fucking festival. They used to call us the ducklings because we were so, we couldn't believe we were in the comedy world. So just like all the older comedians would be at, Glenn Wool would be out drinking and we were big Glenn Wool fans and we'd hang out. And Glenn's lovely, so he'd let us hang out. Yeah. But there was always times at the Sydney Comedy Festival where you would just see like an older, more experienced comic like walking past, and then 3 seconds later, me and Reese Nicholson running after them like two little drunk ducklings. And so we were just called the ducklings for years. Everyone took us under the wing, especially like Century, the production company that brought me over. They've always looked after. They're very hands-on. And a lot of my agents and producers have always been very hands-on. You know, I like having friends. I'm a very open person. I don't mind being solitary. I can go weeks, you know. Oh, no, maybe not weeks, but I can go a couple of days in my flat, not talk to anyone, and I'll be fine. It's not a sad thing. But I do like human interaction a lot, and I like closeness. I like having friends to, you know, because I'm not that closed off. I'm very open about things. And when you're not close friends with someone, I'm like, I've got a lot of things on my mind that I'd like to just to not bring up in a sad way, but in the way we do it now, we just go, I want to talk about this thing that's been in my head. I want to be able to make fun of it. And just, I don't know what it is about the Aussie comics is, I've always felt more welcome in the Australian scene than I do in the UK scene. And I don't know why that is. Maybe it's just because whenever I come to Australia, I'm in Sydney or I'm in Melbourne, whereas on the UK scene, I live in Edinburgh and I fucking refuse to move from there. And I did the circuit for a bit, but I don't do it as much.
Why did you not move? Because for a lot of people, it just would have been one of those things where you're just like, well, if this is what I want to be doing with my life, you know, you got to get it, move to London and, you know, go on the circuit and do that. Why did you decide, nah, that's not for me?
Nobody could rationally explain to me why I had to move to London. None of it. There was nothing. They were like, you got to be there for work. And I'm like, yeah, but I live in Edinburgh. Like, there's a train station and a plane there. Like, I can get down to London at any point. Like, it's not the 1800s. Like, it's not even fucking 1960. Where it's so easy to get fucking it. I could be in New York in 9 hours. Well, maybe not from here. But, like, anywhere in the world I could be in within a fucking day. Right. Like, that's just the world we live in. So you to tell me that I have to move somewhere for something is utter horseshit. It's just not true.
Yeah, the only thing I'm going to miss is last minute emergency bookings.
Yeah.
That's if you have more than a day to plan me getting to where you're going, we can arrange this.
Yeah. And also I think that, yeah. I think there's that thing in my mind. If I'm in London, if I'm readily available for everything, when I live in Scotland, you don't know how fucking empty my diary is, right? You've got no idea, right? I'm going to look, I come down, oh, Sloss is in time for the week. We got to get him on fucking everything. Yeah. If I live in London, are you free? Yeah. Every day I'm fucking free. It's just, and also I don't live in London. I live in Scotland. It is my home. It's, you know, I truly believe I would not be the person I am today if it wasn't for my friends and my family.
Because it's interesting to me also that perhaps you, and it may be something that is in your future, but because you've had, you know, some really good success so far, particularly for someone your age in America. You know, you've done Conan a bunch of times and, you know, done some, you know, touring there and, you know, clearly have an act that, you know, would work well in America. You know, there must have been a temptation or at least a suggestion from somebody at some stage that you
all the time
move over there and live, right?
What would it take you to move over? My answer is always £2 million.
Yeah.
I need enough money to buy a house out there and a private jet that can fly me home to my real house every fucking weekend. Right. It's always been like, I love Scotland. I love Edinburgh. Yeah.
It's a beautiful city.
It's beautiful. And also, like, this has always been a joke answer of mine, but I do also genuinely mean it. Nobody's fucking bombing us, right?
Right.
Nobody's bombing Scotland.
No.
We might get bombed a bit eventually, but, like, when all the missiles go off, nobody's like, oh, yeah, let's get those cunts in skirts. It's not happening. No. There's 6 million of us. We're not a threat. Like, in the current political climate, I'm like, it's the safest place to be. Like, we're just, you know, I think Trident-wise, we've got some missiles, but they're all in the sea. I don't mind if you bomb the sea, kill the fishes. I can give a shit. Never been a shellfish fan anyway. But
no, I agree. I mean, that makes sense to me. And environmentally, it's still an okay place to live.
Absolutely. You know. Sea levels rises, so give a shit. I'll just move up the hills.
Yeah.
It's not like here where the sea level is rising. You're like, oh, fucking, this is a lot of flats. This is. Whereas in Scotland, like, yeah, we'll just move 30 feet up the hill the next couple of years. Be grand. Just get a caravan, pull up.
Yeah, I just moved into this house, and at the moment I'm about 10 minutes walk from the bay. But I imagine while I live here, that'll get closer and closer, that walk.
Yeah. I don't have to move closer to the sea.
Yeah.
The sea will move closer to me. That's how real estate agents start selling property in Australia. Yeah. Like, it's not a beachfront. Yet, but in a
soon to be beachfront location.
Yeah, you just start investing in stuff like a mile inside Melbourne. Yeah. You're like, in 20 years, yeah. Papa gonna own a condo.
Yeah, you're just I want the third story. Yeah,
they're all gonna have pools.
Yeah, yeah. With like a lot of, they're getting a house inspection with all the charts, and you've also just got a lot of climate change charts. This seems like the peak zone.
Yeah, this will be where it'd be. This would be a nice pool, probably a deck here that we can dangle our feet in.
Yeah, well, there's certainly some parts of Alaska that are just gonna get. That are already pretty amazing, but that climate change is going to turn into, like, there's going to be a sweet period in Alaska for about 40 years if that's where you wanted to live, somewhere nice legal weed and you know, good environmental conditions, Alaska. But
in America, I don't have the reason I wouldn't move there. I would obviously move there for a bit of work, and stay there for a long period of time. But for me, I don't have my that's not where my support network is. Like, that's not where my mom or my dad or my brothers are. It's not where my cousins are. It's not where my friends are. Even though I live in Edinburgh and like a lot of my friends live in London, again, it's so easy to go down, and I do go to London regularly to see. So I always attribute my home as the UK. Even though I live in Edinburgh, it's very easy to get anywhere within the UK. It's an hour away from anything. And it would be a fun new experience. But every time somebody moves somewhere, for me, I'm like, okay, you didn't like the life that you had, so you've gone to see if you can make it somewhere else. I love the life that I've got. And nothing so far has made me need to leave where I live. I mean, it might change in the next couple of years. Like, it's starting to get to the stage now in a lot of my friendships where, you know, my friends are slowly dropping off. Not dropping off in a bad way, but they're moving and they're getting into these relationships, and I'm suddenly going, you know, that's a genuine fear of mine. Am I slowly watching my support network disappear, and then I won't have moved to the States? I won't move to the States because I was staying here to be loyal to them. But meanwhile, they've not taken me into consideration, because why would they?
Right.
They're living their lives.
Yeah.
They're having a joy. I would be upset if I factored into their decisions in their future. Yeah. That would be unfair.
What happened with you and Mandy? Well, look, we know you've given up a lot to stay here.
Yeah. Look, yeah, it would just be real shit. It's like, look, I'm massively in love with her. Yeah. I want to have kids with her. But, you know, you threw some pretty sick house parties about 3 years ago, and so, I guess I owe you for that. So here we are.
It's interesting what you say, and I think it has some relevance to, certainly when I moved to America, part of the reason that I moved to America was that I didn't want to be here anymore. Or I didn't want to be here all the time anymore. It was less about me wanting to be. That's the honest answer. It's not the answer you give people when they ask you, why did you go to America? And there was a myriad of answers. But the main one was that I had got to a point here with my life and my career and, you know, how careers go here.
Mm.
That next stage of it, the bit where you're a bit everywhere and ubiquitous and everybody knows who you are and, you know, that just comes with the cost of doing business. It's just never been the most exciting part of the job for me.
Mm.
I've always much more been comfortable. You know, I love just getting up, doing stand-up, you know, in a room full of, you know, people in a, you know, above a fucking pub or, you know,
like a fucking comic book shop.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love it. Like, that's, to me, them, you know, if you ask me about my favorite gigs, they're all going to be gigs like that. And I just love doing that. And I'd almost got to a point here where I couldn't do that anymore.
Yeah, too big.
You know, I needed to go away for a while so that could all get filled in, and then you can kind of come back. And now what I crave, what I notice that I've craved is I want to be back here now.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You know, now I'm like, I've missed all those things. I want to be close to my family. I want to see my friends more. I want to reconnect with them, because they're now past that bit where they go away. Mm. They're at that bit where they're coming back. You know, like their kids are old enough and, you know, they're all back doing stand-up and, you know, you can go and have a night out or a catch-up or a network of friends that you can, you know, have adult friendships with again. And it's, and I miss that. Even though I have great networks and friends and stuff overseas, that thing that you're saying, I feel like both of the things you said to me, I completely connected with, because I think I did move away less because I wanted to go there and more because I didn't want to be here. Yeah, and then I've decided that I wanted to be here again.
Yeah, you didn't want to be the last one left.
Right.
Like just sitting there being like, oh, all right, grand. Okay, let's...
Well, you know what it is? It's essentially what you were saying. It's like, because if I'm in America in a like apartment by myself, recording some podcasts and doing some road dates, that feels like I'm doing something. But if I'm just here alone in a house doing some shows and people are like, what's going on with Will?
Yeah, it just doesn't, is he okay? He's doing exactly what he did here. Yeah. It's just the way he's doing
it. Here it feels pathetic. I meant to ask you if you have a philosophy towards anything.
I don't.
I mean, you have millions and we've already talked about heaps of them.
Yeah.
Like, so the idea that I then have to put a button on this and say, is there one? But is there, you know what I'd like actually from you? Like, because I do think I know a lot about your perspectives on things and you're like, a lot of the time, you know, your perspective on things is actually contained in your material as well.
Mm.
Was there particular comedy or things that comedians said, you know, when you were starting out, were you the sort of person who scratched around for, you know, I was talking to someone the other day about, I remember Eddie Izzard saying, you know, of the Pythons that, you know, comedy was either like, you know, treating something really silly with great seriousness or treating something serious in a, you know, silly way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Things like that, little tidbits that you're kind of like, oh, okay, that informs a little bit of how I think about comedy. Were you a person who was looking for that from other comedians? Because being a young person, I guess what I'm asking is, how did you learn about comedy at that age?
So when I was young, my dad just made me watch. He didn't make me watch anything. I heard my dad laughing downstairs. And then I was in bed. And obviously laughter is a huge part of my family. So I'd hear my parents laughing downstairs and I walked to know what was making them laugh. So I'd wake up and I'd pretend to not feel well. And I'd go downstairs and I'd lie on my dad's chest and we'd watch Jack D or Mark Lamar or Phil Jupiter's. And I was just I was literally just laughing at the swear words. I didn't get any of the fucking jokes. I was just laughing because my dad was laughing and someone was swearing. And swearing is hysterical.
Right.
Especially when you're seven. And then just... watched as much stand-up as I could. Like before Netflix, I used to just go on eBay and just buy any VHSs. So I've got some really fucking weird DVDs. I don't know if you've ever seen Jamie Foxx's stand-up special.
I have.
It is the worst fucking thing I have ever seen. And I think he's hugely talented as a person.
I agree.
That stand-up special is unforgivably shit. He's got catchphrases. The catchphrases that he forces on the audience at the start, they're not from a thing. The catchphrases are not from a previous set. They're not from a movie. He just says things repeatedly and then gets the... One of the ones he does is just at the end of a joint, he pretends to smoke a joint and he goes, "You gotta blow that shit out." That's it. That's it. And by the end of the show, everyone is fucking doing it. So I watched Animal with that. I'm like, I'm never fucking doing that. I'm absolutely not becoming the catchphrase comic.
By the way, the only reason I ever saw that was I was doing Just for Laughs in Montreal. And, you know, they give you a little gift package at the start of the festival. And it had that DVD in it.
No.
Yeah.
That's such a bad one to give away.
Like to a bunch of comedians at an international comedy festival.
There must have been a level of them just being like, look, this will actually make most of the comedians laugh. Because this is...
Maybe that's what it is. Maybe that was the encouragement. It was like, look how successful he is and look how terrible he stand up is.
You could all do better. You could all do better. It's called Into the Foxhole, if anyone wants to give it a look online. It's honestly atrocious. But I remember the first time I watched Jim Jefferies. And I think the one was like Ed Byrne. Was the two times I'd ever seen comedians. And they said something, they made such a good point about something. I think it was Jim Jefferies' stuff about atheism and stuff, because I was an angry 13-year-old little fucking atheist. And he was being funny and he was making a point. Like he was beating people in arguments, but by being funny. And that's, you know, and I loved that. I was like, fuck, that's such an intelligent way to, you know, do it. One, in the sense that, you know, you're being funny, so you're diffusing a lot of the tension when people disagree with you, because you're still making them laugh and you're pointing out holes in yourself. But also, what a great way to not let anyone else get a fucking word in an argument. Like, you get to have an argument on stage and nobody's allowed to interrupt because you're hypothetically playing the other side of it.
Yeah.
I really...
What's that? I'm convincingly winning this argument I'm having with this straw man I created for this post.
Yeah. I loved it. And then I remember seeing...
I also love, and that's one... I mean, it's a thing that I was very, very much guilty of, and it's still like a thing that you... do a lot when you're talking about those sort of issues, something you disagree with. You know, you will often create the, you know, very convenient straw person argument that
that none of them would ever make. Right, you've just narrowed it down and taken away all
perfect, you know, takedown of that argument. What I've noticed I've started doing as I've got older, and I've just like, yeah, you get bored by the cliches of things, is what I love more than anything now is creating a straw man and then losing the argument.
You know? That's great.
And like, and like the audience, it really does kind of, because I guess they instinctively know that I'm making the whole, like I'm in control of what the other person's saying,
yeah.
But I've lost the argument regardless.
That's very good. I like that. Yeah, just be like, just you and them, and like, just your final rebuttal is, yeah, well, yeah. Well, you shut up. Like, fucking hell, Will has lost it. He used to be so...
He's really been destroyed by this figment of his own imagination.
But do you know, I think the reason, another reason that you've done that is, and this is a field I'm getting into with my show next year, we've got to keep finding ways to surprise our audiences.
Right.
Right? So the way you would always surprise the audience in years is, you know, you would always make these good points. You'd have these straw man arguments where you would, you know, destroy the person, and then you'd shock the audience by maybe, you know, finding the humanity in that person, or maybe you can see where they're coming from, and, you know, or you talk about like a time when you went through that experience. Any of the other many things, ways we can perform a bit to shock the audience and surprise them. Do you know, I think maybe that might have been a way that it's like, what's now the one thing I haven't done in front of the audience? Oh, I haven't lost an argument in front of them. That's the only way, because otherwise it just does become samey and repetitive. For the past 3 years, all my shows have been 50 minutes of just stand-up fucking comedy, and then 5 minutes of, all right, cunts, here's my soul, right? And just really, really catching them off guard, being like, all the fucking actors drop. Nah, remember that fucking confident cunt you saw for 55 minutes? Nah, he's a scared little boy. How comfortable do you feel now? Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Back to the rest of the fucking show. And I love that bit. I love the, you know, being honest on stage and the challenge of going, what is the most horrific or honest part of myself I'm willing to reveal? But at what point am I going to tear another layer off myself and they're going to go, we know.
Right.
You're deeper than you were last year. We get it.
Well, also the other thing is, though, that is there a... Because you've kind of dug a lot already... At such a young age,
mate, I'm begging for tragedies at this point. I really fucking am. Like, I've done heartbreak. I've done my dead sister. Right, this year I had to bring up something that happened to me at 13. Nothing bad. I've just spun it in a way that makes it much more. Like, fucking honestly, my mum needs to cop it. Like, for my art, it's getting to reveal. There's nothing. I don't know what to do. It's a genuine thing. It's that horrible thing as a comedian going, But I also don't want to come up with more, because at what point does it just become a straight white man going, I've got struggles too?
Oh, no, you passed that point a long time ago.
Okay.
don't feel bad about that. That's the
that's
the thing the other 30% of comedians are saying about your work.
I meant that's what my show's called next year.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I've got problems too. Daniel Sloss of White Guys Can't Empathize fame.
How do you work on the process of having a bold statement about something that, you know, you must have the intellect to realize that at your age, there's going to be some things that you're saying now that 5 or 10 or 15 years from now, you are going to look back on and think, who the fuck was that? Who was this guy? Like, is that exciting to you? Is that like a is terrifying to you? What is that to you?
Can't wait. Can't wait. I have always said, if I do not hate my, if I do not hate this show in 5 years, I've failed in 5 years. Like, I can't watch the stand up I did 6 or 7 years ago. One day I will be able to, but it's still just too close. I'm like, oh Jesus, look how fucking cool you think you are. How smart you clearly think you are. Oh, look at you being all deep. Oh, what a deep and complex individual. You fucking narcissist. Like the way I play the, I want to feel that way about my show now in 5 years. Of course I do. But also, what a joy it'll be with 5 years' time, the straw man in my argument will be the younger me.
Right. No doubt about that.
I can't fucking wait. I might one day just do, you know, my show last year was about breakups and how, it, you know, being single's great. And, you know, I force all these couples to break up. Maybe in 5 years' time, I'll be marrying another kid and I'll just be like, you fucking angry little dick. This is all, no. That's a fallacy. Maybe the whole show will just be me doing a rebuttal to that entire show.
You know what real love is?
Yeah.
Wanting your partner to die and then loving him again the next day.
Yeah, yeah. That's true love. It's going through. True love. They make you feel everything.
If you're the sort of person who just gave up on somebody because one day you felt like you wanted them to die.
The real reason you broke up with them isn't because you wanted them to die. It's because you were scared at one point they would have that thought. And you need to be loved at every fucking moment. The fact that they would even for a second not have you, the sole person in their life, wasn't enough for you. And you couldn't fucking risk it, you tiny little coward.
Which is the title of the show.
No, I know, and I know how much my opinions have changed so much in the past 3 years, and they will. And that I do love the fact that I just still go into everything with the same full 100% conviction of, nah, I'm going to think this forever. You guys are fucked.
I think that there's a real power to that. And I was watching Becky Lucas's special on the ABC. They played us it was a half hour special and they played on the ABC. And I just happened to be home on a Saturday night. And, you know, I'm a big fan of Becky's. And she's
great.
Been, you know, she's done some opening and stuff for me over the years. And I just think she's a great comedian, but also just a really fun person to hang around with, you know. And I was at home by myself and, like, the special came on. And I was like, you know what, I'm going to sit down and I'm going to watch Becky's special. And the thing that I loved about it was how unapologetically of her time and her life it was.
Yeah.
Like, she made no pretense to broaden out the appeal of some of the, you know, like the jokes or the scenarios.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it was so age appropriate, you know, like the confidence of someone her age.
The conviction.
The dismissiveness, the, you know, the idea that these are the things that are important to you when you're this age, as opposed to all the other things that people tell you that they're. And I love that sort of comedy. And I think that's very similar to yours. It's like when I see a 26-year-old talking about what it's like to be 26, to me that's and acting like they're 26.
Yeah.
Like often when you get older, that people go, they look at the young ones and they're like, he's always so full of confidence and he thinks he knows everything. I'm like, yeah.
That's what they are.
He's 22 and he's had like 8 good gigs in a row. That's what you're meant to be like.
He's got much less to compare
it to. Okay, mate, he'll learn. It'll be fine. Yeah. But let him have this.
Look, if he's like this when we're 40, we'll have a serious fucking word.
But we all worked it out, mate.
Trust me, life and comedy is going to kick him very hard in the dick pretty fucking soon.
Yeah.
Just let him have this
Remember
optimism.
That moment we all were lucky enough to have at one stage where we went, oh, I've learned this all. None of this could ever go wrong ever again. Let him have that.
Yeah, because as we all know, it goes away.
And these are my definitive opinions, and they will never change.
I've thought
this
through.
And certainly society will not change in a way that makes these opinions offensive in retrospect.
Yeah. Just everything. Look, everything's going to stay the same because they have done for the past 2 years of my life. Yeah. Just so you know, 2 years in my life is 10%. As opposed to, has it been 2 years? Oh, God. Yeah. When you start comparing, how old other people have got. My brothers are now 18 and 15, and that blows my mind. That's a moment I never watched. That's when I knew I was getting. And again, I know the irony of a fucking 27-year-old telling you he's feel like he's getting older, but it's when you just go, in my head, my brothers are still 13 and 9. I haven't updated any of that. My brain hasn't updated the fact that my 17-year-old brother can beat me up now, because all I can remember is beating up a 9-year-old him. And so we, not beating up, but we would wrestle all the time. Whereas now I'll still get into wrestling fights with him. He's 6'2", right? He weighs at least 2 stone more than me, and it is all muscle. And I'm like, he's 9. I'm his older brother. The laws of the universe dictate that I get to fucking kick the shit out of him. So I'm worried that maybe things maybe won't update in my life. I can't update the ages of my brothers in my head based on the physical evidence of them there. Maybe I will be this stubborn and stupid forever.
I mean, maybe. I don't think so. I doubt that will be the case. Tell me about being in the middle of a comedy festival, because we talked on Faux Fop the other day. It was right at the start of the festival. Now, when we're catching up for this podcast, it's the middle of the festival.
Yeah.
What's it like? Just give people a bit of an idea of like what a festival is like. The idea of like getting up on stage every night and you sort of examining those ideas in front of different audiences. And it's close as you get to a kind of focus group, because if you're going from place to place every day, like, you know, if I'm playing in Melbourne tonight and I'm playing in Sydney tomorrow, or even if I'm playing in one venue in Melbourne tonight and then another venue in Melbourne the next night, there is so much about the environment that resets your day a bit, you know, like you're in a different room, you're in a different environment.
You have to get on a plane. Site,
whatever, right?
Yeah.
But this is not that. This is Groundhog Day in some ways. But the audience is different every night. The response is different every night. Just like give us some insight into, you know, like as a comedic artist in the middle of a festival, like what's that process like?
I live my life midway through a festival. I honestly believe if my mother or any of my close friends saw the way I truly lived during the festival, they would be so sad and worried for me. Like, I genuinely think if they were to walk into my apartment now that I'm saying, they'd be like, is everything okay? And I'm like, no, this is just the way I live. And they'd be like, that's awful. Like, this is, I honestly, because my show's at fucking 9, right? So yeah. I'm not waking up at 9 a.m. Fuck that. I'm not waiting 12 hours before I have to do my work. What I'm going to do is I'm going to wake up about 12 or 1. I don't really eat in the morning. My stomach hasn't fully woken up, so I'll just fucking sit and I'll do. I'll not shower. And then about 3, I don't want to eat. I'll go, I should eat.
Right.
That's what people do. And then I'll just, and I won't go to any of the plethora of lovely restaurants in Melbourne. I'll go downstairs and I'll get a sandwich or a microwavable meal. And I can't express to you.
Never have you been more Scottish.
Yeah. I'm so happy throughout this whole process. And I'll just sit on my phone and I'll look at my memes and I'll go.
I'll sit on my phone and I'll look at my memes.
If James Fosdick, if that's the fucking quote he puts on the fucking artistic photo of me, I've seen the Edelman ones where they're all like deep quotes about him doing stuff in comedy. If the picture of me is I sit on my phone and I look at my memes, I will fucking deck James Fosdick.
You know what? You have just guaranteed that he'll, because he'll often send me one or two different versions. And I bet he sends at least one now that it's I'm just sitting on my phone and look at my memes. And if he doesn't, he's getting sacked.
I mean, it's a rock and a hard place for him. He's either getting sacked or getting decked.
Yeah, well, I'd like to think that he could take a punch, but I'm not sure that his family could take me withdrawing a massive contribution to their finances.
All right, fine. I'll mug him.
Yeah. mate, we're going to wind this up soon, but...
It's the rest of my day is not as bleak. For me, it's about keeping myself in a normal
prepared
state.
Prepared for the show.
Yeah, and which is, you know, if my friends want to go for dinner, I'll absolutely meet them. Yeah. Because after the show, once I've got the adrenaline pumping, I go out and I'll always go for a meal afterwards and I'll hang out with my friends and I'll drink, and that's the social aspect. Because I know from 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock onwards, right, I'm 100% talking to people at that point. I'm doing an hour of talking. I'm meeting people afterwards. I'm going to go to the bar because I want to see all my friends and I want to make sure they're all doing good. So for the whole start of the fucking day, I don't mind just not performing.
I've been doing a lot of these podcasts mostly because the people I want to talk to are in town because of the comedy festival. Ideally, I wouldn't be doing them now because... I've got radio in the morning, I'm doing my show at night, and it's, my brother messaged me the other day, he was down from the farm, they were in the city, I ended up catching up with him on Sunday, but on Saturday afternoon, he was like, oh, we're down, what are you doing? And I just had to send him a message and said, I'm not talking. That's what I'm doing today. I'm just literally all day. All I want is to just not have to talk.
Yeah, I don't want to have to stimulate that part of my brain, because it stimulates so very regularly, and I love the moments. I love them.
Yeah.
Of course, you love talking to your brother. He's your brother. You love talking to my friends. Right. Points where I'm just like,
and I want to see you tomorrow when I can fully to you and enjoy talking to you.
Yeah.
But today, I'm just not talking.
I'm just not talking. That's a very good way of dealing with it. I'm still at the desperate stage where if someone, I'm like, yeah, of course I'll come out and meet up with you. Like, I can't let people down.
So this podcast always ends, and we've kind of like talked about it a bit already, and I am kind of aware of, you know, your beliefs in this area, but, you know, it's what I talk about with everybody, so I'm going to talk about it with you as well, which is, what do you think happens when you die? I don't mean the faux funeral. I mean, what is your belief system? You've mentioned you're an atheist. Is that it? Mean as in like you die and you're done and that's it. That's the end of everything.
100%.
Okay. So if that is the case, I've asked you this before, so it seems weird but we're doing it for this podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
In that case, what is this?
it's the most joyous accident. Like, I genuinely, the amount of people that say, do you not find, being an atheist, after you die, do you not find that depressing? And I go, no, I genuinely find it more, like, this life is, and I hate to use the word miraculous, but it's a statistical anomaly.
Right.
We are all, every single one of us should not exist. For me to exist, my parents had to fuck at pretty much the exact moment they fucked for me to be this sperm for that specific egg. That point in their life, even that point in their life where they were, how they raised me, had it been, I wouldn't be that person. And for my parents to exist, their parents had to do that, had to fuck at the exact same time, and their parents, and so on and so forth, for fucking ever. It's the chances of you existing are statistically impossible. It's not possible that any of us exist. Yet here we are.
Yeah. So why is it this ridiculous fucking mess that our lives are, where we think that all these things are important and this is the way we've arranged each other?
If
we are indeed a statistical anomaly in the corner of the universe, which, by the way, as you know, is what I also believe.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I guess the next question is always, then why this? Why is it this? Why are we why is this accident? How has it become this?
I don't know, but I also don't want, the fucking answer necessarily. Like, I love
I do, this. And I'm going to stop doing this podcast as soon as someone answers the question.
You just get the final answer to life, and then you just disappear in smoke. You just dust away a strong gust of wind. Ah, he got all the answers. It's just very peaceful. Nobody's sad. He did it.
Yep.
He did so many of the philosophy podcasts. He finally got the answers.
He finally cracked it.
Or it's just the person that says is, what is this? And somebody just goes, it's all about that pussy, mate. And you're like, no, not that. Oh, no. He wasn't that deep. it's a real, you know what? Turns out it was that.
Turns out it was. It was just all about that.
I think that's the fucking fun of it. Like, you just go through life going, what's the meaning of it? Like, and I don't think there is a meaning to life. I think there is a meaning to everyone's life. And I think that changes so often. For some people, the meaning of their life for so long is, you know, charity and helping others. But then it becomes about their family, and it becomes about their kids' success, and it becomes, or about their kids' happiness. Or there's other people who it's, you know, they were in a young relationship and then they lost the thing. So it's not about love and say it's not for them anymore. It's about then going on to charity, but traveling the world. I don't think there is no meaning to life itself. I think it's up to you what the meaning of. The meaning for my life just now is my family, my friends, and my job. That is, I live to hang out with my friends. I live to connect and learn more about my parents and my brothers. My meaning of life is getting to know all the people I love and doing the job that I love And that's not the case for everyone. And I wouldn't want it to be the case for everyone, because I'll be honest with you, I don't want any more fucking competition.
I was going to say, it'd make the industry so...
Yeah, I don't want it. Everyone else, fuck off, mate. Right,
I feel like it's time to put up a wall. A wall around comedy. And I'm going to make the non-comedians pay for that wall.
Which they are. Like, they're coming to see the shows. Like,
yeah, it's going to be a brick wall, like a comedy club.
Yeah. And I'll occasionally break the fourth wall during my comedy. But... I will tell you that there is not a meaning to life, but I would never tell you that there was not a meaning to yours.
There you go. That's done. That's the way you end it. Look at that. Yeah. You can have
James
quote.
Fosdick, put that on a fucking one.
You can put that one on and the one about on his phone checking his memes. They've both got to be there.
It's the real juxtaposition of my depth and complexity as a human being.
Thank you, Daniel Soss.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, hang on. Let's plug shit. I'll do plugs at the top as well. But, after the Melbourne Comedy Festival.
I'm doing Perth Regal Theatre at some point. I think it's the 26th or 27th.
Yep.
And then I'm doing Sydney Enmore. Same sort of time.
And then if people want to find you on the internet and, if this is the first time that you've heard Daniel and I talk, there are so many episodes of FOFOP that you can go and revisit.
Yeah. I would strongly recommend. The one I still think is funniest is... white guys can't empathize, or you got to cough to get off.
Yeah. Yeah, there's been some fun ones.
Oh, there's been some fucking
over the time. Yeah. Daniel was not lying when he said his parents are funny. There is a moment that I won't spoil, but if you're willing to go digging deep, you will discover one of the great Dr. Les Sloss moments of all time will certainly... convince you that his parents are as funny as he's told you.
Yeah, the bastards.
All right, mate. Thank you.
Thanks, buddy.